I myself am a child psychiatrist. I did train in pediatrics, but I went briefly to a COVID medical unit, which really opened my eyes as to the extreme levels of stress experienced by frontline COVID unit providers.
I'm Josh Fader, Editor-in-Chief at the Carlisle Child Psychiatry Report. I'm here today with Dr. Linda Chakraverty, who is my colleague on the Disaster and Trauma Committee at the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry. She is the co-chair, and I try to be the international liaison.
Thanks, Josh. I appreciate your inviting me today on this important topic around what's going on for us in New York City with regards to the pandemic. So I'm an attending physician at the Montefiore Hospital in the Psychiatric Observation Suite in the Bronx, New York, and I'm also an assistant professor of psychiatry and behavioral science and pediatrics at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine.
And can you tell us about the scope of the problem you're facing regionally right now?
Yes, you probably have been following the news, and you know well that we in New York State are unfortunately the leader in the world's share right now of COVID-19 cases and deaths. And we're certainly the most heavily affected region in the United States at the moment. As of yesterday, we had over 263,000 identified COVID-19 cases and sadly more than 19,000 deaths to date since the onset. And we alone in New York City have more than half of the cases in our state. And we hope that what's happened here, in that we've had an exponential rise in cases and fatalities, we hope it's a reminder of what could happen in densely populated areas if measures to control the outbreak are not undertaken in that timely and aggressive way, and what could be done differently. It's very reassuring to see states such as yours, Josh, in California, Washington State, who experienced the earlier cases, to have stabilized the spread and really flattened their curve. And we do know that staying at home and social distancing really works.
We have flattened our curve. The side effect of that is that people don't believe that it's a real problem. And I think we may end up having a lot of people leaving the stay-at-home orders prematurely, putting us at risk for rise again. But, you know, I do want to get back to, the specific role of child psychiatrists and colleagues who are also assessing and treating kids with mental health difficulties in this situation. I mean, one of the reasons why I really wanted to speak with you about this topic today, Linda, is that I know that people need to learn from the experience in New York, because sadly, I know that we're going to be repeating that experience in many places throughout the country, particularly places where they haven't necessarily closed down as much. I don't think they know what they're in for. So I'm trying to figure out how to help prepare them. So I'm just so grateful that you're here. Your governor has certainly been on the air daily. Do you want to talk a little bit about what's been happening on a policy level and what the governor's been doing?
Yes, and could have easily been any other state if the numbers were this high as well. But, you know, we really are fortunate in having, at this point, pretty aggressive measures that we've been asked to take. Our governor told us yesterday that we are on day 53 of state shutdown, and this has actually helped our illness curve to stabilize. We believe that our peak has already happened and is now on a slow but steady decline, but we still have painfully high numbers of cases and casualties, and we can't be sure that it won't uptick. At our own Montefiore Health System hospitals in the Bronx and parts of Westchester County, we had our peak about 10 days ago, and we had over 2,000 hospitalized patients. And we're now in the 1,600s. Even more sobering is that we've had unimaginable numbers of deaths per day. At our peak, we had over 800 a day. And now we're, you know, in the perhaps 400s, 500s, but it's still quite unimaginably high. And we're very high in terms of cases per 100,000 people in the Bronx. So our governor issued a mandate during this state of emergency that he's called, not only to expand our hospital beds in the area for critically ill COVID patients, but also expand the scope of our practice as healthcare practitioners, regardless of specialty, to enable all hands on deck, which includes retirees coming out of retirement medical students being graduated early from schools, whether as employees in the hospital systems or as volunteers with the state medical reserve corps to supplement the healthcare force. Therefore, we could expect, and in reality, have experienced a profound change in the landscape of care, where the sick patients are being treated, the role changes for doctors. Examples of this landscape change include committing almost all hospital units entirely to COVID care, which involves changing areas, even such as pediatrics, to COVID care for young adults and older people. Never had we imagined that entire ERs with multiple patients are going to be on ventilators, or step medical units are step down units and all the patients are on oxygen masks until now. Now we've seen it. We also in New York City extended hospital programs to provide care in a variety of other alternate settings, including sports complex, field hospitals, a psychiatric center, a large convention center, and a Navy hospital ship. As physicians, because of these policy changes and these additional demands, our roles have changed. We've been deployed to provide other kinds of care than what we're used to performing due to this massive expansion of hospital beds and responsibilities. I myself am a child psychiatrist. I did train in pediatrics, but I went briefly to a COVID medical unit, which really opened my eyes as to the extreme levels of stress experienced by frontline COVID unit providers that we read about in the news. Will a patient die suddenly? There are days when so many patients per day have died. Did I properly don my personal protective equipment, my PPE? Did I have any gaps? Did I have an exposure? How can I provide palliative care, something that I might not have been trained formally to do, to a patient who was just healthy a few days ago? Our trainees, our staff, and those at other institutions from multiple specialties are all deployed in many ways, many cases on medical units, and the senior trainees are filling in for junior ones, putting their own training rotations on hold while their younger trainees are providing the COVID care. So in my usual role as a psychiatrist, we have to be mindful at this point of having sufficient PPE in the emergency room, given the ubiquity of COVID at the moment, of the coronavirus, and whether this is as consultants to patients who are COVID positive or navigating infectious areas in the emergency room nearby. We are actually in a neighboring room, but we're all exposed. And we're still very much in the acute stage of this disaster, which is very different than other things that are very specific and discrete events. This is a continuous acute event. And being that there's a stay-home mandate at the moment, we're seeing a lot less psychiatric patients in the ER, although that seems to be changing even as we speak. Only the truest of emergencies, and not the relative ones that sometimes we can solve by outpatient means, are coming to see us. This is a good thing from a public health infection control standpoint. However, we do have to see what will be happening in the next few weeks, now that we're several weeks into the lockdown, as to what kind of mental health crises can be resulting in our patients and families from being in confined space for extended time without regular school, with high levels of family stress. Sadly also, and this is pretty significant, we all know people, family members of friends, our own colleagues even, and sometimes our relatives, and certainly people in the lives of our patients who are losing loved ones to COVID-19. Death and bereavement experiences have become extremely common during this crisis. And what's even worse is that we can't have our usual rituals around death and supporting each other through gatherings because of the restrictions, further complicating our grief. As for approaches to how we're addressing our situation as faculties and faculty members and direct caregivers in the psychiatric setting, we're really in the midst of what we would characterize as the acute phase. And therefore, it's highly important that we apply what we call the principles of psychological first aid, or PFA, in our regular work. And PFA is a public health approach to reduce distress and promote resiliency during the immediate stage of any disaster event. It includes making sure people are heard and feel supported. It's called the listen component, ensuring they are safe by screening for danger such as domestic abuse and increased misuse of alcohol and drugs, sending them home whenever possible quickly and avoiding overexposure in the community so they don't get sick. That's the protect component of PFA. Facilitating social connectedness and communication with family and friends, as well as resources they might need, such as food and shelter if they don't have it. That's a connect component. Modeling of calm and optimistic behavior while promoting a sense of efficacy is important for ourselves as well as our patients. And education on expected reactions in the short term, which tend to improve as things stabilize around us. And finally, helpful practices that will help you cope, such as limiting your exposure to the news and overstimulating material in the internet. That's the teach component. So as a faculty and supervisor to trainees, I've seen my main role in at the moment as to check in and see how everyone is doing, and teaching priorities that include maintaining our own health and resiliency, as well as that of our patients. As you know, healthcare workers are actually among the most vulnerable of the population, in addition to children and adolescents being vulnerable, because we are directly exposed, and the degree of exposure to stressful and traumatic events is correlated to the level of future distress and sometimes negative outcomes. So our own care is quite important. And as I mentioned, you know, a lot of us have gotten sick with the coronavirus and we're out and having less of us sometimes to cover for each other, we're doing our best. We will be able to get back to our usual teaching once our routines are more like what we know. As far as patient care, my usual approach is to send psychiatric patients home from the ER whenever possible. That continues to hold true, but especially now more than ever, since our current goal is to do no harm. The main difference now really is the speed at which we try to move our patients along. Inpatient units in the area have had to deal with coronavirus exposure, isolation, and worse, sometimes acute illness. We want to avoid this experience for our patients right now if we can help it. Helping parents understand and avoid the serious risks of having their kids exposed in the community, then bringing back COVID-related illness to vulnerable family members, this is an urgent issue which our parents have been able to appreciate. As a result, I've hospitalized far fewer patients than I've sent home. And other things that I think are important right now include reviewing healthy practices with patients that come to the ER, hand washing, social distancing, limiting travel and movement, and the correct use of masks. There's also a serious educational role we have to play on the importance of routines, sleep hygiene, physical activity, and nutrition. We need to screen for access to educational resources right now because not all our kids in the public setting have equal access to remote learning, and helping them find those connections is extremely important and appreciated also by families. For kids who are already in treatment and has had their care disrupted, maybe they're trying to get an appointment with their clinic but can't because many of the clinics are closed or just opening up and running now with telehealth appointments. Many programs only have telephonic appointments without video, and that can be less satisfying for providers and patients. Some of these patients are in limbo. For those people, we think sometimes minor medication adjustments in the ER, like increasing a guanfacine dose or a schedule change or titrating an antidepressant up slightly, these are some tactics that I personally use in the ER. And perseverance from our ER team in helping patients access services for the first time through new referrals has been very important, especially, as you know, we have long wait lists and a short supply of child mental health treatment options well before the epidemic. So back to our own self-care, we have to practice what we preach around best health practices right now during this prolonged acute phase of the pandemic. This includes the triumvirate of good health, sleep, nutrition, exercise. Of these, I would say nutrition for us has been the most accessible thing. We're fortunate to have a lot of food donations from the community to the hospital. The hospital has also been very generous to provide us meals. And importantly, when we're home, we have a chance to cook meals and have family dinners since we can't eat out. Exercise is possible, but more challenging, as you know, since gyms are closed. Outdoor activities are more restricted with stay-at-home orders, as well as mandatory masking in public. sleep, and perhaps most importantly, has been the most difficult to accomplish reasonably. Stress is very high right now, and we're inclined to overuse caffeine, go to bed late, not have the best sleep routines. I personally found that I can't read the newspaper at bedtime anymore, even though I usually do that to relax because it contains too many upsetting pieces of information. And so I've had to find other sleep rituals as well as other types of activities at different times to relax, such as audiobooks, meditation, yoga, mindfulness. We're very lucky to have a variety of resources within our own institution at Montefiore for mental health support. We have calming rooms. We have volunteer short and long-term mental health treatment options. And we ourselves in our Department of Psychiatry are involved in many cases as volunteers in supporting the mental health of other healthcare workers in our health setting. And there's even outside, if we need it, a national physician support line now for COVID-related stress that volunteer doctors are operating to help confidentially. If you're in another part of the country that hasn't yet peaked or have the misfortune to experience a reemergence, here's what I think will be helpful. First, make sure you know ahead of time where the PPE is located in a given healthcare setting. Sometimes it's not where you think it is, and you need to know ahead of time and locate them and make sure that you have what you need, especially if you work in an ambulatory environment or need to deploy to an unfamiliar hospital to help out. It's very important. And if you are deployed, ask for live training before the deployment. If you have not done medicine in 25 years, before the age of EMR and high tech, as I had done. While they're helpful, it's not enough to have instructional videos or study on your own under duress, especially for those of us with older than young adult brains. Maybe we can learn that way, of course, with palliative care, as that's closer to some of our work as psychiatrists. Number three, I would say have a bi-directionally supportive relationship with your trainees. They're often more up to date on technology, social media, and efficient use of the EMR, more so than many of us. And we can learn from them as much as we can teach them right now, especially during a crisis. Number four, I would say, is to work hard to limit our exposures, not only to infections, but excess work hours, overstimulation in the healthcare setting, and overexposure to news around COVID-19. Number five, I would say, to take time to do calming activities, to ground ourselves, check in on family and friends quite often, especially those that may be more alone right now, and reach out to existing patients to let them know you're thinking of them and checking in to see how they are. Many of them worry about how we're doing, and it's actually good for our own relationships with patients to tell them that we're doing okay. And as far as patient care, we need to make sure and be vigilant around keeping them safe from coronavirus illness, educate them on healthy practices around physical and mental health during this crisis, but also screen them for vulnerabilities that could lead to future negative outcomes, such as post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, alcohol misuse. Those are the three most common. Screen them for vulnerabilities, which include previous traumatic events and losses, imminent abuse, neglect, food, housing, economic insecurity, as well as increases in substance abuse in the home, all of which will further complicate already fragile mental health conditions. Finally, as before I mentioned, we're a very vulnerable group as healthcare workers, and we should ask our colleagues for help if we need it, and we should provide help to them if we can. And we should take full advantage of any of our own in-house support programs that we may have. And we should consult helpful online resources such as the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, the National Child Traumatic Stress Network, the Center for Traumatic Stress Studies, and of course, the CDC. So I wanted to thank you again, Josh, for this great opportunity to share my experience and give some practical suggestions in managing these unprecedented times that we're going through right now.
I want to thank Dr. Chakravarti again for speaking with us today. I think this is really critical to our colleagues across the country and even internationally, because many of us are going to be facing very similar things. The resources that Dr. Chakravarti alluded to are on the website. I want to add one more from the American Foundation of Suicide Prevention, 10 Facts About Physician Suicide and Mental Health. That'll also be listed on our website. Take care, everybody. We'll be back with another episode soon.